Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, bringing you the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa every weekday from 7 to 8. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson, together with station engineer Mike Murphy. And I'm not going to bother Mike to add his 2 cents. Or do you want to add your 2 cents? This is a big day for KHOI.
It is indeed a big day. Here we are broadcasting for the first time ever. Well, this is our first live broadcast. We've been broadcasting on and off for the past several days. This is our first live broadcast from our new location, 622 Douglas Street here in Ames, and we're excited about it, aren't we, Greta?
Yeah, very much so. It's lovely here, and congratulations to the KHOI engineering team on this fabulous feat. And in case you're missing some of our regular accoutrements of this show, that would be why we don't have them. We're still working out some of the kinks. Weather-wise, it's shaping up to be a mild week. The weather we are experiencing now in Ames, 9 degrees Fahrenheit, will likely be the coldest temps we have all week. Yay! High of 31 today, 40s in the subsequent days, and sun with a few clouds, no precipitation in the forecast. We've got a couple of good guests lined up for us this Monday morning, but first, it's Central Iowa News from Dennis Hart.
The coronavirus, lots of action in the state legislature, and Iowa National Guard troops heading to Poland all made big news around the state last week. First, the coronavirus. The state health department reported 156 more deaths from the virus last week, raising Iowa's death toll to 8,657 since the pandemic started. Those deaths occurred between mid-October and late January. But for the second straight week, the number of new reported coronavirus cases and hospitalizations in Iowa went down. The state health department reported 16,663 new cases on Friday, compared with 22,730 new cases on Wednesday, and the state's 14-day positivity rate had dropped to 18.9%. And 741 people were hospitalized with the virus in Iowa, down from 929 the week before. And while all this was going on, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds announced she would soon end public health disaster proclamations that the state has operated under since the start of the coronavirus pandemic nearly 2 years ago. That will include pulling the plug on a state website focusing on coronavirus data, such as the number of Iowans testing positive for the disease, being hospitalized with it, or dying from it. And the state will no longer collect data from Iowa nursing homes, instead using information from the federal government. 109 Iowa nursing homes had coronavirus outbreaks last week, compared to 86 the week before. 455 more nursing home residents or staff members in Iowa were infected. 15 nursing home residents died of the virus. The biggest outbreak was at the state-run Iowa Veterans Home in Marshall County. There were 92 infections there. This was the 7th outbreak at that home, more than any other Iowa care facility. 2 Story County nursing homes were reported to have coronavirus outbreaks, Bethany Life with 28 infections, and Northridge Village with 12. Meanwhile, last week, the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa asked several school districts that have dropped their coronavirus mask mandates to reinstate them, or face lawsuits to get them to comply with federal law. The ACLU said it had sent letters to 8 of the 10 school districts involved in a federal lawsuit against the state's ban on mandates, informing the schools they are in violation of a recent ruling by the 8th Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals. Also last week, word that Iowa would use part of its federal emergency rental assistance money to expand services for people experiencing homelessness. The state will use more than $21 million to help house hundreds of homeless families and connect thousands more to community programs such as mental health or sobriety testing. Also last week, the governor released her plan for education. In it, she's calling for school districts to publish their curriculum and lists of library books online. And she wants to let some parents use taxpayer money to send their children to private schools. And her bill would require students to pass a U.S. citizenship test as a requirement for high school graduation. And last Wednesday, Iowa state senators gave their initial approval to 3 major education proposals to create a state-funded program to send children to private schools, to approve a parent bill of rights, and to set a growth rate for state supplemental aid. And state Senate President Jake Chapman filed a bill that would let parents sue schools and have teachers and administrators face criminal penalties for distributing obscene material or hardcore pornography to students. Also last week, Senate Republicans advanced their proposal for individual and business income tax cuts through the Ways and Means Committee, making it eligible for floor debate this week. That plan would gradually reduce the state income tax to 3.6% and eventually phase it out entirely, eliminate the tax on retirement income, reduce the state tax on business income, and trigger funding for the state's program for conservation and water quality projects. And the governor said everything is on the table when it comes to negotiations with Republican lawmakers on tax cuts this year. She and Republican leaders in the state House and Senate have introduced three different plans to cut state income taxes. They all share the broad goal of reducing individual income taxes and exempting retirement income from taxation, but they differ on whether to cut the corporate tax rate and by how much. Meanwhile, state Democrats unveiled their tax plan that focuses on reducing taxes for middle-class and low-income workers, in part by expanding tax credits for parents. Democrats also plan to propose income tax rate reductions for middle-class workers, but those details are still being worked on. Also last week, State House Republicans were moving to shorten the length of time Iowans can receive unemployment benefits by 2.5 months. If the House bill becomes law, Iowa would go from offering 26 weeks of jobless benefits to 16 weeks. Workers would also be required to take lower-paying jobs sooner or risk losing their benefits. And last week, Iowa House lawmakers passed a bill requiring gas stations to offer gasoline with higher blends of ethanol at the pump. That was a major step forward for one of Governor Reynolds' priorities. The measure passed the House on an 82-10 vote, with most Republicans and Democrats supporting it. The measure now goes to the state Senate. Under the House bill, gas stations would be required to offer 15% ethanol, known as E15, starting in 2026. There was also word last week that some Polk County elected officials would make more money than Governor Reynolds this year. The Polk County attorney will make more than $230,000, while the sheriff will make more than $191,000. And members of the Board of Supervisors will make $135,000. Governor Reynolds' salary is capped by the legislature at $130,000 a year. In the U.S. House of Representatives last week, Iowa Democratic Congresswoman Cindy Axne introduced a bill that would require businesses to provide health insurance for striking workers. She said she started working on the legislation after she met striking United Auto Workers members outside the company's Ankeny plant in October. Meanwhile, last week, word that the Iowa National Guard would be sending 250 Iowa soldiers from Mason City and Iowa City to Poland to help with the mobilization of troops in Eastern Europe. The soldiers will provide transportation and field hospitals for troops sent to keep the Ukraine crisis from spilling into neighboring countries. In other news last week, the Des Moines Register reported that nearly 1,800 bridges in Iowa are in what's being described as basically intolerable condition. More than 140 of those are in the Des Moines Metro. This, according to information from federal highway officials. In the past 2 decades, Iowa has seen at least 3 bridge collapses like the one that took place in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania at the end of January. Among the bridges in poor condition, one in Des Moines that carries 2nd Avenue traffic across Birdland Drive just north of the Des Moines River. Cars cross that bridge more than 18,000 times a day. Also last week, word that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency plans to reject Alliant Energy's effort to continue using its Ottumwa Power Plant's coal ash storage pond, saying it's concerned the site lacks sufficient groundwater monitoring. The EPA also denied proposals to delay closing ash ponds at 2 other Midwestern plants, one in Indiana, the other in Ohio. Coal ash is a byproduct of burning coal to generate electricity, and it can contain contaminants such as mercury and arsenic, which are linked to cancer and other health issues. Without proper management, those substances can pose a hazard in waterways, groundwater, drinking water, and the air. There was also a report that Summit Carbon Solutions had taken the next step in building a 680-mile carbon capture pipeline across 29 counties in Iowa by asking the Iowa Utilities Board for a permit. The underground pipeline would carry liquefied carbon dioxide from a dozen Iowa ethanol plants to a mile-deep storage site in North Dakota. Summit Carbon Solutions is an Ames company that is one of 3 firms that want to build carbon capture pipelines in Iowa. And there was word that Iowa farmers, along with farmers across the nation, could expect income from crops and livestock production to go down this year, as costs go up and government payments decline. The U.S. Department of Agriculture expects American farm income to fall to $114 billion this year, down about $10 billion from last year. In other news last week, word that Iowa's notorious lottery thief is out of prison and on parole after serving 5 years of a 25-year sentence. The Iowa Parole Board decided that 58-year-old Eddie Tipton could be released 20 years early. He had pleaded guilty to lottery scams in Colorado, Wisconsin, Kansas, and Oklahoma. The parole board agreed to let Tipton be released to live in Texas, which has a lottery system but was not one of the states involved in Tipton's lottery scheme, in which he wrote software that let him predict winning lottery numbers. There was also word last week that three University of Iowa professors had violated school policy in the way they handled a complaint against a graduate student who had told classmates he considered homosexuality to be sinful. A university investigation found that student Jacob Johnson's advisor and two other faculty members he consulted had failed to properly investigate the complaint against Johnson and had wrongfully imposed restraints on his free speech without evidence that the interactions he had were harassment. And last week, word that a major wholesaler of Budweiser products had been fined $225,000 for a beer sponsorship with Drake University Athletics that authorities said violated federal trade practices law. Dahl Distributing reached an agreement with the Alcohol and Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau that said the sponsorship with Drake to control non-craft beer sales at the Knapp Center during the 2018 and 2019 basketball seasons was illegal. That contract named Dahl the official domestic beer sponsor for Drake University Athletics. And that is your summary of a busy, busy week of news from all around Iowa. Let's both catch our breath now. I'll try to get mine back tonight at 7, when I'll join Laura Bellin on KHOI's Capital Week, where we'll hash out all that went on in the state legislature last week, what's coming up next, and what it means for all of us. Then I'll pay a return visit to this same virtual seat on Local Talk this coming Friday morning, when I'll have word on what makes news in Ames. Until then, here's hoping you have a great week.
Okay, thank you, Dennis Hart, from your virtual seat. You're always so reliable. You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson. We are in our new digs here at 622 Douglas Avenue and experiencing all the things that we experience when we do something new. Thanks for tuning in and sharing this experience with us. And on our Zoom line, we have Eric Schmidt, who's the Communications Director of the Ames Community School District, as promised. So, Eric, are you listening?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Absolutely. Fabulous. We got a lot to talk about, but the obvious topic on the table is our new superintendent that has been Julius Lawson from Chicago. Tell us about Dr. Lawson.
So this is really exciting. One of the biggest pieces of news that we've been able to share over, you know, the past couple weeks. It's been, you know, really a semester-long process for us as a school district and primarily the school board. A little bit of backstory. The superintendent's search started in the fall last year, probably really late summer, where they partnered with a search firm, HYA. And so we hit, there's a really a lot of marks that we hit in order to go through a search firm like this. So they contracted with them. And then one of the next big pieces that we did was really engage our community and stakeholders to get their feedback on what they are looking for in the next superintendent. And so that happened in October through a stakeholder survey. And then there was a couple small groups that HYA met with as well, and they compiled all of that information into a leadership profile. So then they take that and they go through all of the candidates. They brought six candidates initially forward for the school board to meet with and interview. From there, they narrowed it down to two, and then earlier this year, in 2022, January 24, we were able to publicly announce Dr. Julius Lawson as our next superintendent of Ames Schools. So as you mentioned, he is from Chicago. He's the chief of schools there, or one of the chief of schools there. He oversees a large part of their district, primarily elementary schools. And so I was fortunate enough to be part of that finalist interview, and so I spent a little bit of time with him, not a lot, but just from what I've you know, the time I spent with him, it was really wonderful. I think he's going to be great for our community and our district.
Cool. So can you tell me, tell our listeners, what kind of participation was there in the, you know, you mentioned that there was a stakeholder survey and meetings. Can you describe the kind of participation and perhaps even the results, the message you got from the stakeholders?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, like I mentioned before, the leadership profile going through that stakeholder survey was the that was the advice given to us and the school board by HYA. So there's a couple different routes that a school district can go when searching for a superintendent. As you can imagine, it's a very high profile position, but also in order to get the best candidates, there was two considerations that we took. One was the timing of the superintendent search, and so the window that we hit, we're really in a good period of time in order to get some of the best candidates, you know, for our next superintendent. So we wanted to make sure that it was done earlier in the year, because as I outlined, you know, it can be a really long process, several months, and so it's not just you post the opening and then get a couple applicants and then you know, choose your next superintendent. It is a process, and so our window that we hit was really good. The second consideration that HYA and the school board really talked through was how to do the search. And so what they decided on was to essentially do it as a confidential search. And what that does is, as you can imagine, if you're drawing some of the best candidates to this position, they're also leading in other school districts. And that can get really complicated once you get to, you know, a certain part in the process. If that does get announced, it can create some complications for them in their home district as well. And in fact, HYA, having gone through this a number of times, in fact, that, you know, this is what they do, they have seen candidates not apply for positions just because they don't want to really experience what could be some, you know, backlash in their home districts for, you know, why are you leaving? What, you know, what's going on? That type of stuff. So those were two of some of the biggest considerations that the school board took when going through this process.
Okay, but I'm kind of curious about this, what the stakeholders, what the feedback from the community was about what they want to see in a new leader.
So one of the things that, so we have posted a summary of the leadership profile on our website. We have a page that, you know, was dedicated to the superintendent search, and we outlined all the dates. You know, one of the biggest ones that we saw and heard from our community is to ensure that we continue the equity work that we're doing in our district. So I would say that was one of the biggest ones. And obviously, engaging with the community, you know, that's one that we want in a superintendent, and having met Dr. Lawson, he's going to be absolutely wonderful. In fact, that's going to be one of his primary goals when he does get into the school district.
Well, he has got a wonderful smile and in the picture that we have here. And, you know, I get the sense that he might just be that kind of person who just, you warm up when you see him, when you are near him, and feel welcome and that he is receptive to your presence. Is that kind of the sense that you got when you were meeting with him?
Yep. I think you nailed it. I think the picture does encapsulate him. He's a very engaging individual. And again, I'm basing this off of, you know, the couple emails that I've sent him, and then about the hour that I spent with him as well. But he is ready to go. Just every correspondence that I've had with him is, let's get out into the community. I just want to learn. You know, every new community you go to, there's, you know, you have to build context around things. And so it's a good and bad thing. So, you know, in education, our contracts run from July 1 and then they go to June 30. So, you know, although we're announcing this in January, or we did in January 24, you know, his contract doesn't officially begin until, you know, that July 1, you know, and so that's, you know, that can be like, wow, let's just get going, you know, and I'm sure he's feeling the same thing. But at the same time, I know that I'm sending him, you know, some emails, just a lot of like our updates that we send parents, I'm also sending to him, just so that we have these several months of, we can build some of that context remotely. I know that he's going to take some steps to get into Ames and our district over the next several months as well, you know, because he's going to be moving. And so, you know, he's going to want to connect with people to find, you know, where's he going to live in Ames and stuff like that. So I know he's going to be ready to get into our district. And then we'll take some of those opportunities as well, just to meet with them and get them into some of our buildings and just to continue to build that context.
Okay. And some of the details that from the article that you posted on the website about Dr. Lawson, that he has worked with early engagement to motivate post-secondary aspirations. So I understand that as someone who works mainly with the elementary schools there in Chicago, he's kind of planting the seeds early on of, hey, you know, you can achieve, you don't have to be, for instance, held back by the educational attainment of your parents or your community. You can go beyond. You can do this, and I've always just admired that particular kind of approach to things. He seems to care a great deal about bringing forth the best in the children that are in the schools.
Yeah, we are excited, to say the least.
yeah. I mean, we've struggled so much to figure out. We've identified a problem with our equity, with achievement, an achievement gap. We've struggled to know how to address this. And he seems to have some of the solutions. Another detail from his bio is that referrals to the principal and school suspensions actually went down under his sort of oversight of a district. And that's really key, just to connecting with students enough to let them know that, there is a reason they're in school. It's not as some kind of punishment. We do hope that they, move through life with goals and so forth. So, all right. Well, that's very exciting. You spent a whole hour with Dr. Lawson.
Yes. I led one of the groups. There was a small community group that was part of the finalist interviews, and so I was fortunate enough to be asked by the school board to lead that group. So,
any moments from that hour that you could recall?
I think I hit on most of them. I mean, it's just when you're in education, for decades that, you build a certain capacity, you understand kids, you understand systems, you are in it to teach students. And you noted it, Greta, just, the way, as engaging as he is, he's just a wonderful person to talk to. And in many ways, which can kind of, transition us to, another topic, is getting out into our community and just talking with people face to face. I mean, I know that's something that he's going to love to do. He just wants to get out and meet people and learn and talk about not only his experience early on, but, over time, just to talk about our school district. And so that's one of the biggest jobs of the superintendent. Like, yes, they oversee budget. They work hand in hand with the school board, and these are all important things. But, another really big piece of being superintendent is being the face of the district and getting out and talking to people. And I know that's one of the things he's going to be really excited to do.
Okay. So you've got a couple events, moving on to our next topic, scheduled for the public to talk directly with school district representatives about what's been going on in the schools, the state of the schools, as it were. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah, absolutely. So on Monday, February 28, we're going to be holding two state of the district public forums. And so a little bit of backstory to these is that earlier in the fall, the pandemic seemed to be, working in our favor, at least at the time, and maybe we wouldn't agree with that necessarily now. But, we wanted to use it as an opportunity to engage people face to face. As a school district, we are always susceptible to, you know, the rumor mills on social media about, well, this is happening and that's happening. And oftentimes, you know, there's maybe nuggets of truth to some of that, but it doesn't always necessarily mean that everything in that is always true. And so how do you, you know, how do you engage people with learning about our school district that isn't just a written piece? You know, we share information with our parents and our staff, and we send that stuff out. But, you know, things can go any which way, you know, on a particular topic. And so we scheduled a number of just community events. And the idea was that these were just going to be rolling events and that we can always meet with individuals who represent, you know, community organizations. We'll come, we'll do a short presentation. We're happy to answer questions on any topics. Oftentimes it was, you know, myself, our superintendent now, Dr. Paula Vincent, our assistant superintendent, and we would just basically do the rounds within our community. And we felt like, and because I was here during the bond referendum in 2017 and 18, and I felt like, you know, we did a really great job of reaching out to our community to talk about our school district, primarily because we wanted to educate our community on the upcoming bond referendum. We took a little break after that time to, you know, maybe catch our breath. And then suddenly we were hit with the pandemic and we weren't able to really get out to these community organizations and community groups and just talk about our school district. And so really that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to connect with a lot of community members who maybe didn't have a direct connection to our school district. You know, as I said, we have, you know, emails to all of our parents, to all of our staff, so we can get information to those groups. But the reality is that the vast majority of our community maybe doesn't have a direct connection to our school district yet. You know, they see things on social media. They read certain articles in the newspaper, which doesn't always encapsulate the entire story around a given topic. And so, you know, we met with, you know, the Chamber of Commerce, Rotary, Kiwanis, and, you know, our plan was just to continue to meet with ongoing any group that wants to, you know, connect and meet with us. And so through that process, you know, we very clearly got some feedback from our community that, hey, we should have like an official state of the district event. And so that's what this is on the 28th. We're going to hold two of them on the 28th. The first one will be at noon at the Ames Public Library. It'll probably be about an hour. We'll have a short presentation that we've been doing at all of these community events, and then we'll be able to entertain and answer questions once that presentation is over. And then we're going to do it again at 6:30 at our district administrative office. And on that one, we're going to do it remotely as well. So we'll do a hybrid version, just the way we do our school board meetings. So we'll present the presentation via Zoom. We'll record it and post it on our YouTube channel so that people who may not or are not able to attend, you know, maybe they're shuttling kids around or have another commitment, then they can watch it remotely.
Cool. So that is that a Monday then?
That's a Monday,
yeah. The 28th at noon in the library for anyone who wants to attend. And then to get a Zoom link of this meeting is you know, how do you do that?
Yeah, we'll post it. We'll post it on our website. We've sent it out to our parents and staff already.
Sure.
Again, going back to whose email address do we have? Yep,
yeah.
We've sent it out to all of our parents and staff already. We'll send a reminder.
Right. Okay. So yeah, there was some confusion there for a while about what these official meetings were. There was one scheduled at the Efree Church, and folks were a little confused about what exactly the import of that was. It was just that church inviting you to come speak and discuss what's going on there.
Yep, that's right. And since posting or since announcing, you know, this meeting, we've had a couple other groups reach out to us. You know, sometimes the state of the district, you know, forums, they're great. And I think they're great to get information out. And I'm excited that we're going to do it. You know, some organizations may have some slightly custom, you know, type questions that they just want clarity on. And so we've been reached out to by a couple organizations already. Just, hey, can you meet with our group? And, you know, absolutely we can. So, and that's, so these are just going to be ongoing meetings. And my plan, knowing that I'm going to be here during the transition from, Dr. Vincent, our superintendent, now to Dr. Lawson, is just to kind of get in this flow of having these types of meetings. So I know that, you know, essentially we're going to have a bunch of meetings that we've done this year that we can, you know, duplicate and add to in the coming years with Dr. Lawson as well. It's just great to have those connections out in our community. It's great to, you know, we can send a quick email and then we can get just something scheduled just to be able to meet with different groups.
Yeah, and it sounds like it's a great opportunity for two-way communication, not just to get out information about things to the public, but also to hear their concerns and, you know, be able to consider them at, you know, at great length and focus on the things that the community thinks are important.
Yeah. You know, I always, I think about this often and it kind of makes me chuckle. In my first year in the district, so I'm in my fifth year now, my first year in the district, Dr. Taylor was our superintendent at the time. And, you know, he tasked me with leading our bond referendum. And he says, hey, the one thing I want you to do, I want you to find that magic button that when you, you know, when we have information to share with our community, we can just hit that magic button and then everybody knows about it. And sadly, I have not found that magic button yet. But, you know.
It's KHOI.
Yeah, KHOI. I mean, this is part of it. I mean, that's it's funny you say that. You know, our website hits certain people. Our social media hits certain people. I also always joke that, you know, as a communications professional, when I hit send on something, I hit it to 700 staff members and, you know, 6,000 parent email addresses. Yet I'm also the parent that oftentimes doesn't read those types of emails. And so even, you know, when information is sent, you know, it can be received in different ways. And so, you know, this radio is part of that. Doing these public forums is also part of that communication strategy, just to share information with our community, because not everyone is going to, even if we hit send, not everyone is going to get the information. I completely understand that.
Okay, well, we have probably time for one more topic, and it is February, so let's just take a look at about the equity issues and really just what has happened over the past year, the blowback that our district got from the legislature, and obviously, things could not be done the same way this year. Last week, there was a Black Lives Matter week of action. And this year, you're focusing on the whole month of February as an opportunity to introduce curriculum, from what I understand, that is relevant to some of the minority groups in our schools.
Yeah, so one of the things that we talked about late last year, so, you know, November, December, obviously, we're very aware of, you know, how our district was portrayed, you know, last year as a result of our week of action. And so, you know, what do we do going into this year? And you know, Grady, you noted the Black History Month and taking that entire month. But I'll actually take us a little bit even back. One of the things that, you know, we want to do is really continue to expand our equity work within our district. And so, you know, Black History Month is great, and we should be highlighting that. And, you know, there are other months throughout the year that we should be highlighting as well. But also, you know, we're very conscious and aware that Black history shouldn't just be happening in February as well. You know, our goal is always to be able to embed that throughout the year. And so one of the things that, you know, we're working on is highlighting and continuing to share, you know, our broader equity work that is happening, so that it's not just pockets of tasks. You know, we have this month here and we have this month there and this month there. Well, that's not what equity work is within our district. And so one of the things that it's a collaboration between our equity department and teaching and learning department, is that they, throughout the semester and into the summer, they're doing, they're developing an educational equity plan. And so they've invited We've sent out to our parents and community, hey, if you want to get involved in this and be part of this process, here's how you can sign up. And so they've already had a meeting in January, and they're going to have ongoing meetings, and people who want to engage with this work can continue to sign up and be part of this work. But ultimately, the end goal is to have an educational equity plan for the school district. What that's going to include is some goal areas within the equity plan, academic goal area, but also a culture and climate goal area, and one based on behavior. Part of the planning is to develop this as a team. So I know that in that first meeting, they had, I think, around like 70 different people participating in this. And so to be able to do it collaboratively is really exciting, I know, for those two departments who are leading this work. And so they recorded part of the session where they went over some of the initial information. And then we sent that out to our parents and staff as well. As, you know, we know life gets busy. If you didn't have an opportunity to actually engage with the work live, you can watch it and then still also provide feedback to us electronically. And so so that work is going to continue this semester.
Interesting. So that sounds like another one where it'd be great if that information could get out community-wide, not just to parents. You know, that if you want to, if you have something to contribute to an equity program, and you have, you know, vision for that, you can participate.
Yeah. I will say, for a pitch though, if anyone is genuinely interested in learning more about our school district, you know, follow us on social media. It's one of the best ways that information comes to you. You know, if you are on Facebook, if you are on Twitter, if you are on Instagram, you know, follow the Ames Community School District, because we did post this information on there. And in lieu of having, you know, direct emails to our community, that is one way that, again, the information comes to you to get that if it is something that you're interested in.
Fabulous. Well, thank you for that tip, Eric Schmidt, Communications Director of Ames Community School District. We've got some exciting times ahead. Maybe next time you're here with us, the first Monday of every month, we'll talk a little bit about the new high school.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's so many things that we didn't even touch on today, Greta.
That's right. So thank you so much for your virtual visit to our studio. And we'll be back again next month for more.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Well, next up on this fine Monday morning, we have a visit from the director of Good Neighbor Emergency. There's an A at the end. Lori?
Assistance.
Good Neighbor Emergency Assistance. And so this is an organization that has been around in our community for a while, it seems like. Maybe not everybody remembers.
This is our 25th year. Yeah, this is our 25th year.
Oh, 25th year. How exciting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So tell us about how.
Well, thank you for.
Yeah. There's a bit of a delay.
Thank you.
Sorry.
That's okay. Thanks, or sorry for talking over you, but thank you for inviting me, Greta. I am the director at Good Neighbor, and I'm in my fourth year here with Good Neighbor. But Good Neighbor is an agency that was started in 1997 by local or area, really, faith communities of Story County. And the clergy that met every month would often talk about people who were coming to their doors asking for help with food or rent or, you know, other various things that they didn't have money to pay for. And what they realized that was maybe a lot of the faith communities were seeing the same people, and that they were often running out of money early in the month and then would have to turn people away. So this was their solution to pool their benevolent funds, and volunteers ran this organization. And once or twice a month, you could go to a day that was announced and you could ask for assistance. And so we've grown from there. And we are now an agency that operates full time. I'm the full time director, and we have several volunteers. I think we have six right now, who give us a combined maybe 30 hours a week, And just this last year, we hired two work-study students from ISU, and that's a wonderful partnership because ISU pays 75% of their salary, and we pay 25%. So it really stretches our administrative dollar. But we are just so grateful for all of the support we still receive. And during the pandemic, we really didn't know what to expect when we first had to shut down. But things have really, we've been able to continue and actually increase the amount of assistance we've been able to give out. And in 2021, we gave out about $309,000, and that went to rent, utilities, emergency food, emergency gasoline, and we've added Sci-Ride tickets in the last year and a half, and phone cards, the refill phone cards, and we will help pay for internet. We know that's so important with kids, you know, doing school from home for a while and people working at home. So we're very excited about that. Two-thirds of that $309,000, though, did go to rent and utilities. Of course, that's the greatest need. And homelessness prevention is our main goal in what we do. So it was really interesting to be listening a little bit to Eric and talking about the school district, and especially right now with February being Black History Month. And I think Good Neighbor has a similar philosophy that we want to celebrate diversity and make sure that we have accessibility for everyone who lives in Storey County. And one of the things that we feel is pretty significant is if you look at the Storey County demographics, we are a county that has about 84 to 85% of people who identify as white or Caucasian, just under 4% of people who identify as Hispanic or Latino, and about 4% who identify as Black or African American. And then we have, you know, Asian, Pacific Islander, Indigenous Native American, and kind of a combination. And, you know, people who come into us, we do ask for some of this information just so we can kind of track who it is we're helping. And people self-identify. But I think what's interesting is Good Neighbors, you know, clientele, about half of them identify as white or Caucasian, and about 25% identify as Black or African American, and about 16% as Hispanic or Latino. And what that tells us is that we are a safe place to come, and that people feel comfortable, that we've been able to kind of reach across, you know, sometimes what become barriers for people to feel like they can access the services they need.
That's a lovely way of putting it. And
so yeah. Anyway, we're pretty, So we're very excited about that. The other thing that we find significant is if you look at the gender divide here in Storey County, it's almost 50-50 male and female, which is pretty typical, you know, wherever you go. But for our services, about 75% of the people who come to us for assistance are female, and about, you know, 25% or one quarter are male. And we feel like that's very significant too, that it does show that women sometimes, you know, do have more significant barriers to being able to provide basic needs. And, you know, childcare is something we talk about every day with people, that they're just not earning enough money, the jobs available to them to pay for childcare, or the services or the jobs they have hours that are not that 8 to 5, where it's, you know, more easily, you know, able to get childcare. So, you know, these are things that we have people who want to be working who, you know, just don't have the ability to because of some of these barriers. So we think that's pretty interesting. And we're pretty proud of the fact, too, that we do help people from all over Storey County. Ames, because it's the largest population center, is who we, you know, we have the most people who live in Ames that come to us for help. But Nevada has a significant population, and Maxwell, Story City, Huxley. It's good to know that we're known throughout the county, and that, you know, people, again, feel like they can come to us for assistance. So, you know, one of the things I tell people is when the pandemic hit and we knew we had to close, I kind of wondered, and I thought, oh my goodness, will Good Neighbor be here in 6 months? You know, how is this going to work? But what happened was we did see a significant increase in sort of unsolicited donations, and it really helped us to, you know, up our assistance. We, in 2019-20, well, I guess 2018-19, we only provided about $130,000 of assistance for that fiscal year. And again, last year we provided 245, or that, you know, and it's growing because now in the calendar year we're up at 300,000. But just from July 1st through the end of December this month, we've helped with 172. So we're on track to, you know, even exceed what we did in the last, you know, year or 2 years. And that is only because of the generosity of people here in Story County and some of the agencies. The Asset Foundation that United Way kind of manages, they received numerous donations and were able to share that with area agencies, including us. And Story County, through the supervisors, created a fund when the rent moratorium was about to expire in September. So we got a significant increase, or a significant amount of money from them to prevent eviction. So we feel like even though we had to shut down and now we're seeing people by appointment only, there's just, you know, we've been able to switch and like communicate more through the internet, through social media, and people have been able to reach out to us through our website and through email. And of course, that's how our donors find us also. We're really supported by this faith community still, but our largest block of funding money that we get is from private donations. And so, you know, we're really hopeful that that will continue, and that, you know, we'll be able to continue to be supported by this expanded group of funding.
Yeah.
And I've got a question for you.
I've
talked a lot. What?
I have a question. So oftentimes when you know, people are seeking assistance, there's some kind of means testing. In other words, you know, you have to prove that you are desperate enough to, you know, basically merit this this help, or that you fit a certain category. And you know, because GN, Good Neighbor, is a church-oriented, or, you know, it was founded by the churches and brought together by the churches. I just wondered if there are, you know, are there, are those kind of restrictions? And you know, the other thing that comes with means testing is sometimes there's some, you know, rather invasive questions about the person's life that, you know, they have to answer. And so it becomes, it can become very humiliating and a barrier for people getting help. I'm just wondering, you know, what kind of interface do you have with folks who are trying to get the assistance they need?
Sure. Well, I will say that we work from a very trauma-informed place with people who come to us. Because we know that, first of all, to pick up the phone and make the call or come over and knock on our door, we know that takes a huge amount of effort and, you know, your ability to kind of, you know, put some of your ego behind you. And, of course, we do, our funders do ask for information and want to make sure that their money is being, you know, spent as it's needed to be spent. And so we do ask people for demographic information. This is how we can tell you, you know, like who we're helping and that sort of thing. But we don't have these hard boundaries where it's like if you earn, you know, at least $800 a month, we can't help you, period. Or if you, you know, we do look at situations and while we try not to be invasive, we just say, you know, like, can you tell me a little bit about your situation? Or you can tell, can you tell me a little bit about what's going on? And honestly, sometimes we have to stop people and say, you know, okay, you know, like, thank you for sharing. You know, you don't have to tell us everything. And you know, what we want to know is like, did you lose your job? You know, has someone in your family been ill? Have you had car trouble? You know, that sort of thing. And we never ask why. It's like, well, you know, why didn't you have a reserve? Or why, you know, why did you spend money on this and not that? And so we do try to be very sensitive about that, while also trying to make sure that we can be very accountable about how we spend our money. But I think, you know, we get a lot of feedback from people, and we also try to help them look for other resources, you know, besides ours. We just want to be helpful. We don't want them to walk out feeling like they're failures or like they wish they wouldn't have come. So I think we do a good job. I'm sure we don't hit the mark 100% with every person, but we are trauma informed. That's something I talk a lot with our volunteers and staff about.
Real quick, can you give us a thumbnail sketch of how to be trauma informed?
Yeah, well, you can start by believing people. You know, when people tell you they need help with your rent, you don't suspect that maybe, or you know, they don't, and they're just trying to get extra money. And you can say things like, you know, I'm sorry to hear that, or, you know, this must be really difficult for you, to empathize with them. But again, to, you know, get them to tell as much as they're comfortable with, and, you know, not pry when they say, I'm, you know, something happened with my children or whatever. Just that's all you need to know, is that, you know, like, you maybe had a daughter who was supporting you or paying part of your rent, or a parent who was, and now you don't. And you don't need to say, well, what happened? You know, why aren't they doing that? Or why did your husband leave you? Or why, you know, why did these things happen? It's just like, okay, that's hard, you know, when you had to pick up and leave in the middle of the night or whatever.
Right.
And so being trauma informed, I think that phrase, start by believing, is really important to remember.
Well, thank you, Lori Allen. I know you've spent much of your life caring for people in difficult circumstances, and it seems like this good neighbor is a wonderful fit for you, and it's wonderful that the organization has been growing and finding more ways to reach people. So thank you for being on KHOI.
Sure. And I'll give a little plug. Our website is GNEA.org for Good Neighbor Emergency Assistance. And you can go there if you need help or if you would like to donate to us. And we're on social media also. Thank you, Greta. I've had a good time sharing with you.
Okay. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We heard from... started out with Dennis Hart, then we heard from Eric Schmidt, the communications director of Ames Community School District, and from Lori Allen of Good Neighbor Emergency Assistance. KHOI provides a platform for citizens and public officials to share their views. The views of our guests do not necessarily reflect those of KHOI, your community, nonprofit, nonpartisan media. Thanks to interim manager and resident engineer Mike Murphy, and to producer Lynn Carey for all of her assistance on Local Talk. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. You can access this show, any of our past shows online at khoifm.org, and find links to guests and information. That's khoifm.org. The website also offers you ways to assist us financially. Find the yellow donate button to begin the process of becoming a member of KHOI. Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening. Thanks for supporting KHOI, and we'll see you again on the radio.